Better to have Professor Pavlovsky here. We'll be talking about holomorphic topological sigma models and duality.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. It's a pleasure, always a pleasure to give a talk in Santa Barbara with beautiful views on the way from LA. So what I'm going to talk about is based on a paper, which mostly based on what I wrote in a paper almost a year ago. And it's a kind of continuation, in some sense, of the paper with Witten on geometric Langlands duality. And just a couple of days ago, there's a sequel to this paper which came out. Oops, sorry. So now the numbering is became different, right, this year. So it's a funny system now. Okay. So this is with Natalia Saulova. With a postdoc at Caltech. So I probably will not have time to explain what we really did in this paper, but at least I'll probably have time to explain what the motivation for writing this is. I probably won't explain what we actually did. So let me begin by reviewing what topological twisting is and what it's good for. I'll be thinking about studying supersymmetric gauge theories in four dimensions. And so I'll start with supersymmetric gauge theory in four dimensions. And it's given by some path integral. We integrate over the gauge field, its super partners called gauginos, and maybe some other fields with some action. And the measure, as well as the action, are invariant under some symmetry transformations, which leave the whole thing invariant. So if you think about this integration over the infinite dimensional supermanifold of all fields, then this measure given and action are invariant on the generator of symmetries, which is given by some vectorfields on the supermanifold, more precisely by super vector fields on the supermanifold. And the odd super vector fields are usually called supersymmetries. And these field theories are of interest for many reasons. Now, of course, this path integral is hard to study. We can usually study it in some semiclassical expansion. We consider integral like this and study the path integral in the limit when h bar goes to 0 and do some asymptotic expansion. Now that's we'd like to do better than simply perturbative expansion, or maybe identify certain computations which actually are exact. That is, we know that there are no high order corrections in h bar, so we can actually do the leading term and we know that's the exact answer. And one way is to look at the sector of this supersymmetric gauge theory known as topological sector. Now, what is a topological sector? Well, one way to identify it is to look at the same field theory but in curved space-time. So it's in some four manifold, which we call M4. And if it's some generic, we imagine that we do Euclidean field theory. So M4 is a Riemannian manifold, not Lorentzian one. And on a general four manifold, all supersymmetry is destroyed. Because supersymmetry parameters are spinners. And if for them to provide symmetries on curves, in flat space-time, there must be constant spinners. But in curved space-time, there must be covariantly constant spinners. And generically, there are no covariantly constant spinners at all. So you lose all of fermionic symmetry. Now, in order to preserve some supersymmetry, so you need to modify the theory somehow. To preserve some harmonic symmetries. And the way it's done is one modifies this kind of the way, you know, various fields are assigned spins, that is the way they transform under the structure group of the tangent bundle. So technically it's done by choosing a homomorphism from the structure group, which is this is what it's spin for, the cover of the structure group. So the homomorphism rho from structure group to the internal symmetry group of the gauge theory in such a way that after you the point is that supersymmetries transform both under spin 4 and under internal symmetry, but after if you choose some embedding of spin 4 and internal symmetry, you modify the way supercharges transform under spin 4, and maybe some of them will actually become trivial representations of spin 4 after this operation, and those will survive on an arbitrary remaining manifold M4. So now such field theories actually are rather special. What you get, you get this harmonic symmetry as an arbitrary four manifold, but such theories actually are topological field theories in the following sense. So we get the fermionic symmetry. Which means it's actually some odd vector field on the supermanifold of all fields over which we integrate. So this vector field, so Q preserves the integrand in the path integral. It supercommutes with itself. Well, the reason it supercommutes with itself is because, one finds that besides this Q, there's also some bosonic symmetry called the Gauss number, with respect to which Q has some Q has degree one with respect to some grading on the algebra of symmetries. It's supercommutative with itself. It's Lie-Bragg with itself. Must have then degree two. But typically there are no generators of degree two in the algebra, so you're guaranteed that the super Lie-Bragg with itself it just vanishes. So that's not always the case. In some weird cases there's no Z grading, and then this argument doesn't work. And as a result, one can restrict observables to those which are Q invariant. So an observable is simply some function on the supermanifold of all fields. You can imagine inserting this function in the path integral, and let's require also the function to be Q invariant. So clearly there's some sort of trivial kind of function which is Q invariant. So Q acting on any function f is Q invariant. Of this property. So that's because Q squared is zero. Well, it turns out that these guys have sort of trivial correlators. So if you insert such Q exact observable into any into the path integral, the whole path integral simply vanishes. So what really matters is the space of all Q invariant functions modulo sort of these trivial Q invariant ones. One really says that's Q cohomology. Observables, so non-trivial observables leave in Q cohomology. For this reason, Q is often called Gariste operator. And finally, if you just look with respect to this Q invariant observables, then their correlators have a number of remarkable properties. So, so such correlators are known as topological correlators. Are independent of the metric on the manifold. Well, in other words, the completely determinism invariant. Because typically there's nothing else in there. There's no other geometric information which is present in the action, this is the metric. So correlators are metric independent of diffeomorphism invariant, and often are independent of H bar. Or the coupling. Or even if they do depend on H bar, they depend on some simple way.
Is that part plus the topological term in order to have the
probability 4? So the action is Q exact plus. Yeah, term. Right. Yeah.
So you're going in one.
No, this is automatic. Well, this is not automatically follows from some like number.
Oh, okay.
So one needs to check it. Yeah. I don't really know a general proof, but what actually happens typically is that indeed the action, the action is something Q exact. Plus a term which is metric independent, so diffeomorphism invariant. So for this reason, you know, varying the metric doesn't change the action only by sort of Q trivial term, like Q exact term, so they doesn't change the path integral. Same with H bar. One can often, usually the H bar dependence, after some maybe Hilbert scaling, this part doesn't depend on H bar, maybe depends in some very simple way. So then all H-bar dependence also disappears. It's not automatic if you check it in special example. So this last property is very useful because it means one can deform your four-manifold cruelly and you know, nothing happens to the correlators. Or I can do computations at arbitrarily small H-bar and the answer is guaranteed to be exact. So it's a very useful property. So that's one way to obtain exact results in gauge theory, in supersymmetric gauge theories too. A look at the sector, because one is some topological twist, and then in this sector, one can compute some classical and know that the result is exact, and then exactly one can then reinterpret, go back into the supersymmetric gauge theory and just say, okay, well, these observables are simply some special observables in the untwisted theory. So far so good. Let me just remind one application. Recent publication. Well, this was because this idea has many applications. It was first proposed by Witten in 1987, I think, or 88. And there are many applications of this. You know, the whole of mirror symmetry is built on the idea of topological twist, for example. But as for gauge theories, one interesting application is to n equals 4 superangles. Well, actually, this theory had not, well, has a large internal symmetry group, spin 6. So there's some freedom how one chooses embedding of spin 4 into spin 6. So there are three equivalent choices of choosing this embedding, homomorphism from spin 4 to spin 6. But if you just pick one of them, so we have three twists. Well, one is called a Donaldson twist. Then there is something called Wacher-Witten twist. Studied by Wacher and Witten in 1994. And there's a third twist, which is think was first studied by Marcus. So then this last twist, for example, is just an example. What it gives you, well, it gives you topological field theory in four dimensions. And this topological field theory, for example, can be used to study the following issue in gauge theory, which is not very easy to access. So one can, well, one application would be this. So n equals 4 superangles with gauge root G. Is supposed to be equivalent, isomorphic, to another n equals 4 superangles with a gauge group called the Langlands dual of G, and this is the gauge group. Well, by definition, this is a group whose lattice of weight lattice is isomorphic to the lattice of co-weights of G. You know, the weight lattice is the lattice of homomorphisms from the maximal torus of the group to U1, and the co-weight lattice is the lattice of homomorphism from U1 to the maximal torus. So, can exchange if you go from G to G. So this gauge theory is supposed to be equivalent or isomorphic, and it's a conjecture which is hard to test. And one obvious test is the following. So this gauge theory has observables called Wilson loop observables. And they're simply integral, well, they're simply holonomies of a connection around some loop gamma in four manifold. Well, it's not gauge invariant, but we can take take this holonomy in some representation of the group and then take trace. And that's a gauge invariant function in the space of fields. One can insert into the path integral. And now these observables are labeled by irreducible by representations of the group G. Well, any such if R is reducible, then you know this trace also becomes a sum of two observables. So really, independent observables are labeled by irreducible representations of the group and also by the trace of curve. So and by S duality, then. There are such Wilson loop observables also here, so therefore there should be some observables here which also should go at hoofed or magnetic Wilson loops. Whatever they are, should be labeled by the dual date, by dual representation of the dual group. And gamma, and the curve gamma in M4. And there should be some, the point is that in this theory, there also should be similar observables, and then under this equivalence, under this isomorphism, Wilson loop should map to a hoof loop of the dual theory, and vice versa. So one can, in fact, construct such observables. I'll maybe comment on this later, but. What do you need topological field theory for? Well, because you can ask, okay, is it really true that, well, these guys, if you look at their properties, they're controlled by representation ring of the group G. Once you can try to check whether properties of these guys are controlled by representation ring of the dual. So, actually, this representation ring completely sort of fixes the dual, what the dual group is. Sometimes that's the way you see the dual group. So and this computation actually turns out to be surprisingly hard if you do it in full theory, but then it becomes manageable if you do go to the twisted theory. Precisely because of this property that the correlators don't really depend on the h bar. So one can do the computation, the limit h bar goes to zero. And also in the limit when your manifold has a very tiny size, so it's kind of convenient to consider the situation when the manifold is very small. So, well, smaller than k. Well, in practice, what one chooses, one does the computation when instead of gamma, one has a straight line, so it takes a four manifold M4 of this, of the form M3 cross R, three manifold times R, let the lines gamma to be just points in M3 times this R, then take the size of M3 to be very small. That's how it goes. So, okay, so in the one can check indeed this prediction of S duality. And some certain other things, manipulations with this theory lead to statements of geometric Langlands duality. So, other manipulations. Are as follows. So, another special case for M4, take M4 to be a product of two Riemann surfaces. So the standard sort of physical intuition tells us that if you take the size of, say, C to be very small, then in the quantum theory, the quantum theory should reduce some effective field theory on sigma. So four-dimensional field theory on C cross sigma, in the limit when C is very small, becomes essentially field theory on sigma. What kind of field theory? Well, one can analyze this issue. Well, the field theory is basically what's called the sigma model. It's the field theory of mass from sigma to some other target. So, 4D field theory typically becomes a sigma model on sigma in the limit when the volume of C goes to zero. And the sigma model is a model which considers defined by the path integral over maps from sigma to some other target space, which we'll call curly M, and it depends on C somehow. What is a space, curly M? Well, it's basically determined like this. You take the initial gauge theory on C cross sigma, consider its vacua. Consider the case when sigma is just flat, and consider all possible vacua for such theory. Turns out, well, there's more than such vacua. So MC is the actually moduli space of vacua. Vacua for 4D theory on C cross R2. So that is, intuition is this. At any, if sigma is large and C is small, we can imagine that sigma is just R2, and the first approximation. And at any point on R2, if the theory is topological, it follows from that you're only interested in vacuum state of this theory on sigma cross R2, on C cross R2. And then there's a whole bunch of such vacua. Let's pick one. Now, as you move around on sigma, you can actually change the vacuum state on C. And this is how you get a map from sigma to the space of vacuum. You don't have to integrate over all such maps. And this results in this effective field theory on sigma. Now, that's all should happen in the limit when the volume of the C goes to zero, but if you start with the topological field theory, then, of course, we know a priori that nothing depends on the volume of C. So the field theory is exactly equivalent, then, to some effective field theory on sigma for any volume of C. It should be an exact statement. You don't need to take the limit. Okay. And what sort of field theory one gets precisely? Well, one gets some sort of topological field theory on sigma. So nothing dependent on the metric on C or the metric on sigma, and so in the end, well, so the result is going to be some field theory which doesn't depend on the metric on sigma, it's the topological sigma model. Well, strictly speaking, one could even take a metric on C cross sigma, which is not a product, but something more complicated. And you're still guaranteed that the result doesn't depend on the choice of metric. So, let's just assume the metric is a product metric. So therefore the conclusion is this, that four-dimensional topological field theory on C cross sigma is equivalent to some two-dimensional topological field theory on sigma, the sigma model, and well, it has some well, it depends on C, but basically it depends on the topology of C because it's topological field theory in four dimensions already. So in this way, this is the way to relate four-dimensional physics to two-dimensional physics. So some, if you know that certain two gauge theories are equivalent in four dimensions, you can twist to both sides and turn them to topological field theories, compactify on C cross sigma, and then you get some statement about the relations about equivalence of two-dimensional topological field theory. One associated with group G, another one with G dual. Now, that in principle leads to geometric Langevin's duality, for example. So one can try to generalize this method of relating four-dimensional physics to two-dimensional physics. And one obvious direction is to ask, well, in physics there are many dualities, many relationships similar to this one. So this is the first example of what's called the electric non-Abelian electric magnetic duality, but later many more examples were discovered when I have two different gauge theories and they're equivalent quantum mechanically. In principle, they have different gauge theories. So, and the simplest such generalization is n equals 2 supersymmetric angles. Our goal then is to generalize this setup in the case of n equals 2 supersymmetric angles. Well, actually, n equals 2 supersymmetric angles theory by itself is not very similar to n equals 4 supersymmetric angles. It doesn't have this duality. But if you add some extra fields, then you may, depending on how you do it, you can get something similar to n equals 4 supersymmetric angles. So it's a good math. So, what does it mean? Well, n equals 2 supersymmetric angles has the following fields. So, just write the bosonic fields. The gauge field, which is a connection on a G bundle, this has a Higgs field, let me call it something. The Higgs field. Sections of the adjoint bundle, well, complexified adjoint bundle. There's a field which is called Q, which is in some associated bundle via some representation R, and there is Q tilde in the dual representation. So these are all the bosonic fields there are. Actually, complexified. And then the fermionic field, which I will not write out. Now, if R is simply the adjoint, then this whole thing is actually n equals 4 superangles. So n equals 2 superangles corresponds to taking some other non-adjoint representation here. Well, R doesn't have to be irreducible. It can be a sum of several irreducible representations. Okay. Now, if you choose R suitably, then actually the theory is very similar to n equals 4 superangles. One special thing about n equals 4 superangles is that it actually is finite theory. You know, when people first studied quantum field theory, they discovered all kinds of divergences when doing perturbation theory. And then they were very much bothered by this. But n equals 4 superangles is actually a remarkable theory. It doesn't have any divergences in the Green's functions. Okay. So if you do it in a supersymmetric way, so the beta function vanishes In other words, so there's no you don't need to renormalize anything. So it's called the finite field theory. Now this n equals two theories also can be finite if you choose R appropriately. So if R is irreducible. Suppose the equation is simple. So then one way to say this is that you define the index of representation by taking generators of representation R in trace, then it's a number times Kronecker symbol, and this is called, the index of representation. So you can just require that C of R is equal to C of the edge. If this is satisfied, the theory is actually finite. So beta function vanishes. Another way to say this formula, the significance of this condition, which is actually more important for us, is the following. So in the classical limit, R symmetric group here is SU2 cross U1. Now this U1, well, SU2 is present in quantum mechanically, but U1 is usually anomalous. It's not really there on the quantum level. But if you impose this condition, then this U1 actually survives in quantum theory. So it's actually the actual symmetry of the quantum theory. So let's look at these field theories. Now, if one tries to turn it into topological field theory, one quickly realizes there's only one way to do it. So one can do it, but there's only one way to do it, and it's the twist, which is similar to the Donaldson twist of n equals 4 supernormals. So I will not go this way because I want to mimic rather what one gets in the case of this GL twist. Now, turns out that although one cannot twist this n equals 2 field theory into n equals in the way we twist n equals 4 field theory, that is, into a topological field theory, one can do something slightly different. So, after all, well, if you decided to mimic this procedure of considering four-dimensional field theory on a product of two Riemann surfaces and then going, then reinterpreting four-dimensional statements into two-dimensional statements for field theory and sigma, then we don't really need to consider arbitrary four-manifold. We don't really care what happens in arbitrary four-manifold. We only care about this special four-manifold. And for this special four-manifold, the holonomy is U1 cross U1. The structure group really, which is not really small, whole, spin 4 or SO4, it's U1 cross U, reduced to U1 cross U1. So so it's really, you need just to choose embedding of this U1 cross U1 into the R symmetry group. And there are many more such embeddings than there are embeddings of spin 4. Okay. So actually infinitely many which work. But if you want to stay close to the what you do for n equals 4 supernormals, then that chooses uniquely what you do, what you should do. So what you should do is this. So you have the holonomy of C, this 2U1, holonomy of C and holonomy of sigma. So this nice twist is to choose this homomorphism so that U1C is identified with the maximal torus, some maximal torus of SU2. So call this U2 of U1R, it's maximal torus. And U1 sigma is identified with the other U1, this one. So, by the way, in this first paper, I chose a bad notation. Sigma and C exchange compared to what I'm using now. So you see, I tried to, when I started writing this paper, I wanted to, again, to stay as close to this paper in geometric language as possible. And I thought I chose the right conventions to do that. So that is to correspond to the convention of perpetual Langlands on Langlands. And then I realized towards the end, actually, no, I should have chosen rename C and Sigma. It was too late then. So I decided the next paper is going to use the right convention. So I'm going to explain actually in a second why I was misled. Because there are different ways how can you compute C and Sigma. Okay, so we do this. This is a twist. And then actually turns out that the theory has some fermionic symmetry on an arbitrary such, for arbitrary such manifold. Actually, it even has two fermionic symmetries, but they're completely equivalent, so you can pick any one of them. So you can just forget about the other one. So now, what are the fields of this? Well, so bosonic fields, kind of. So the field phi now becomes section of the adjoint. Well, it's still a gauge field. Nothing happened to the gauge field. I guess we've written this. Gauge field still. But the field phi is now get tensored with a canonical line bundle of sigma. Okay. So, and the field q. Is gets twisted by canonical line bundle of C complex conjugate. Okay. Sorry? Oh, yeah, we did the right adjoint, sorry. R, okay, thank you.
R is R, then you go back to anything.
Yeah. Yeah, for any pulse 4, phi and Q dagger are both like components of a one form, which lives in. This is actually one form on sigma, this is one form on C, so dual one form. So if I take phi and q dagger, then they assemble into forms of type 1, 0 on the whole form manifold, or complex form manifold. But in general, they're just like this. Well, q tilde stays what it is. Well, I'm actually slightly cheating here, so. I didn't say it. Well, actually, it identified not with this homomorphism. Okay. You might be surprised that Q and Q tilde have different properties. Because actually, they have exactly the same. They have opposite R charges. So why is one twisted and the other one isn't? What actually I'm doing is I'm using another symmetry here. I'm actually identifying not U1C with U1R, but with the sort of diagonal subgroup of U1R. And some other symmetry, which is known as U1B, the variant number, so which treats these guys in different ways. So the reason it's done, I won't go into this. So that's the right way to do it if you want to stay as close to geometric Langlands as possible. Okay, so. Now, what is the. Well, what does one get? Well, I'm interested in considering this field theory on. C cross sigma. Now I have to reduce. Let's take a limit, some sort of limit when either when the volume of C goes to zero. Now, the reason I got confused is because you know in this situation, of course, one can try to take the limit of when sigma goes to zero instead, and look what happens on C when C is large. And one gets actually rather different results in these two cases, because you know the fields are asymmetric with respect to exchange of C and sigma. That was not the case on equals four superangles. There it didn't matter. So once I started generalizing, it started to matter. So let me explain what happens. But before I go on, let me just sort of explain what I expect. Why is this? Where does asymmetry come from? So, well, the point is this, that since I didn't assume that M4 is a most general form manifold, I'm probably not going to get topological field theory. So what am I getting? Well, if you actually examine BRC transformation laws of fields under this fermionic symmetry, if you examine the action, you find that say supersymmetry transformations, well, Bierce transformations actually don't depend on the choice of complex structure on sigma. So even though this is how I wrote my fields, they sort of assume that they have complex structure on sigma, actually one can write in a way that actually doesn't matter which complex structure you choose. But the choice of complex structure on C does matter. You cannot get rid of it. So the field theory is not topological field theory. It cares about complex structure here. It's a complex curve. But as far as sigma is concerned, it's just a topological, orientable to manifold. Or one to manifold. So you don't need specific complex structure there. So the action can be written in a way which is independent of the metric. In other words, of the Kähler forms here and there. Okay, so the action is Q exact piece plus something independent of Kähler forms. C and sigma. But it's an integral of some form, but this form is, actually even the field content in this theory depends on the choice of complex structure on C. So the theory clearly does depend on the choice of complex structure on C, so it's not a topological field theory. It's kind of holomorphic topological. It's invariant under arbitrary diffeomorphisms of sigma, but depends on the choice of complex structure. Now, it's holomorphic topological in yet another way. You can ask, okay, what happens? Well, in the usual theory, if you could say take some observable, let me call it say O, and okay, ask what happens if I move it to a different point. So suppose it's a local observable, I insert it at some point, what happens if I take it at a different point? In other words, what happens if I take exterior derivative? Well, in topological field theory, you find usually that it actually the exterior derivative is Q exact, which means that it doesn't matter where you insert it. In this mixed holomorphic topological field theory, you don't find that. What you find is this. You have you can ask what happens if you take sort of exterior differential role on sigma, and you still find this. But you don't find the same thing for C. However, you find that if you take Dolbeau differential along C, then it's indeed Q exact. So everything sort of holomorphic along C up to Q exact terms. So therefore all correlators are actually holomorphic functions on C and are completely constants on sigma. It's kind of different from the topological case. So it's another way to explain what it means to have holomorphic topological theory.
In the N equal 4 case, they have these three different transformation properties, or were
they
using
the
different?
They do, but usually there we sort of take phi and Q dagger.
Yeah, I understand.
And they combine them together.
Do you have a Q tilde that didn't transform according to one of the curves?
We do, actually. If you look in the paper with Witten, there is such a thing as well. There is some complex zero form. But it kind of decouples. Actually, it will decouple here as well. It will not enter anywhere, as far as I know.
But that seems to be what's causing the difference between the D and the D bar.
Well, just looking at the field content, indeed, you cannot really see much, because what really settles the matter if you look at Bierce transformations. So Bierce transformations, they just depend on the choice of complex structure. So these Bierce transformations are really different from the ones we used in the paper with. So that is, if you look at field theory on this with the choice of twist, it is all actually has a whole bunch of fermionic symmetries. Actually, not even two. For the adjoint case, it has more than two fermionic symmetries. It has like four. And the one we used in there was actually some other leading combination of these four. But for any also, there are only two. It doesn't matter which one you choose, and they look very symmetric as far as sigma is concerned. So, now, my goal is to draw some conclusions about some conjectural S-duality statement. I just claim that, well, I'll go back to this later, but there is some statement similar to the statement I explained for n equals 4 super angles. Namely, there's some electric magnetic duality which relates to different, which acts on a set of n equals 2 field, finite n equals 2 field theories. So, and I want to reinterpret this statement in terms of two-dimensional field theory, and for that I need to understand how the reduction works. So I already know that if I take the volume of C to be small, then I should be able to reinterpret everything in terms of topological field theory here. But if I take the volume of, I can also try to take the volume of sigma to be small. Again, nothing depends on the Kähler form either here or there. So I can might as well take this to be very small, and I'll get some very effective field theory on C. Let me first explain that, even though it's a bit weird because it's less useful. If we reduce on sigma, then we'll get some effective field theory on C, which is a holomorphic field theory in one complex dimension. So what is it? So let's take now, what are known examples of two-dimensional holomorphic field theories? A classical example is take some conformal field theory which only has, say, right movers. I always confuse with right movers with left. However, after weak rotation becomes holomorphic. So that's one way to construct a holomorphic field theory. So in other words, what one gets is not a topological field theory, but some sort of chiral conformal field theory. Okay. But so it's a bit harder to study. First of all, we don't really understand all as well as topological field theories. So this reduction is not as useful as the other one. But nevertheless, let me explain another way what one gets. So another way to think about holomorphic field theories in one complex dimension is to say, the way they occur in string theory, for example, is via 2,0 sigma models. So these are sigma models which have only sort of holomorphic, or sort of only anti-holomorphic, only anti-holomorphic supersymmetry. It's called anti-holomorphic. So there are some currents which are holomorphic and some which are anti-holomorphic. But let's imagine that we have only supercurrents which are anti-holomorphic. Now, in such a situation, they were not that much studied, but nevertheless, so one can consider a twisted version of this theory. And twisted version of this theory is a holomorphic field theory, because if one to twist, dependence on the anti-holomorphic coordinates becomes trivial. So there is some Q here, such that specimen of the tensor for the anti-holomorphic part is Q exact. So therefore, twisted version is a holomorphic field theory. The most common case is when this is actually conformal field theory is 2,0 supersymmetry, the kind of one uses, say, in hydraulic string theory, but it could also be non-conformal one, like 2,0 Landau-Ginzburg model or something like that. So, what one gets, for us, this hydraulic example is going to be more suggestive. So, what does a 2,0 sigma model look like? Well, it's specified by two different kinds of data. So, have map from Walshit, actually, now since here I have field theory on C. So map C to some target space, which depends on sigma. And you also need to specify some holomorphic fermions living in, right moving fermions living in a vector bundle over this moduli space. So we expect something like this on just general grounds of what kind of models can exist. And that's what one gets. After some little bit of analysis of the gauge theory in four dimensions, it turns out that in our case, M sigma is what's called known as the Hitchin moduli space. This is the same moduli space which appears in the this work on generic Langlands, and more specifically, it's the moduli space. Well, Hitchin moduli space is actually some Hyperkalian manifold, but let me just explain one complex structure in it. It's a moduli space of a flat complex flat connections. So it's a target. And what is this bundle, which also need to specify? Well, on this moduli space times sigma, there's a universal flat bundle. So you can just push it forward to here. And that's what this bundle is. Push forward the universal bundle. So, that's a kind of one way to reduce. And note, by the way, that what I said before that we expect to get some field theory, which is a holomorphic field theory on C, and it's topological along on sigma. No, well, topological character is reflecting the fact that this datum should depend on, that shouldn't really depend on the choice of complex structure on sigma. And indeed, this moduli space of flat connections, to specify what it is, you don't need to specify any metric here or anything like that. It's a well-defined complex manifold. You just think about sigma as a two-dimensional manifold without any complex structure. Incidentally, how does representation R enter? Sorry, I didn't say it correctly. So the universal bundle is a universal principle, GC bundle, but one can take its push forward and then take associated bundle, associated via this representation. That's where we have it. And the anomaly cancellation condition in four dimensions becomes then the familiar anomaly cancellation condition in the heroic string. And there's some anomaly cancellation saying that the degree 4 component of the Chern class of this bundle should equal to the degree 4 component of the Chern character of the tangent bundle. So it's actually ensured by the cancellation of anomalies in four dimensions. Now this viewpoint is not terribly useful. I don't really know how to study this twisted 2,0 sigma model. So maybe might still be useful, but I don't know in what context. So the more interesting limit is this one. Yeah, by the way, the reason I got confused in the beginning because the reason I had notation exchange is because I thought, this is it. This is the good viewpoint, because here the same moduli space appears as in the work on Langlands. But actually that's not actually that useful, because one wants to study the 2,0 model, which is something complicated. Let's look at the other limit where the volume of C goes to zero. So in this limit, one gets topological field theory on sigma, which is expected by a sigma model. So once we think about topological field theories, we expect either a model or B model of some moduli space. One gets actually the B model. And the reason one gets the B model is because somehow the complex structure of C enters implicitly. So the B model of what? The B model of the target space, which I call moduli space of generalized Higgs bundles. So what's that? Well, so a generalized Higgs bundle on C is a pair EQ where maybe Q bar, because Q orientation or something was the dagger or what I'm calling it. So, where E is a holomorphic G bundle, or most strictly speaking, GC bundle, and Q bar is a holomorphic section of vector bundle R of E, where R is some representation of G with associated bundle, tensor canonical line bundle of C. So the usual Higgs bundle corresponds to taking R to be the adjoint. And here we have some other one. So this moduli space, well, there's some stability notion, which it's not very hard to figure out for general representation. We generalize the stability condition of Hitchin for the Higgs, for ordinary Higgs bundles. Now, this moduli space when R is not the adjoint, also when R is the adjoint, that's actually that's what we call the Hitchin moduli space, and that's actually hyperkähler. When R is not the adjoint, then it's not hyperkähler, but it's a Calabi-Yau in the sense that the first Chern class of the tangent bundle vanishes, and it vanishes precisely because it required this condition. Now, I don't know that it's cancellation of anomalies again. In two dimensions, it comes from cancellation of anomalies in four dimensions. Now, I don't know whether this moduli space has actually some sort of canonical section of the holomorphic line bundle. That is, it's the topological condition. So whether it's really a Calabi-Yau in the usual sense, I'm not sure. Yeah, so, but maybe some special section for some reason. So I don't know much about this. So anyway, so this is a constellation of anomalies. On the topological level, this is a Calabi-Yau. So, and that's why the B model makes sense. Okay. Okay, so this is how the reduction works. And now one can ask, okay, what happens? In particular, actually, it's actually interesting even in the case when R is the adjoint. When R is the adjoint, one gets the B model of the ordinary moduli space of Higgs bundles, and one can ask, okay, what does the Montonian Olive duality, which exchanges G and Langlands dual of G, say? Well, what it says, first of all, Montonian, well, for R is the adjoint, so this duality says the following thing. It says that the derived category of coherent sheaves on this moduli space, ordinary moduli space of Higgs bundles, which I call MH, should be equivalent to the derived category the Langlands dual group. So these are the categories of boundary conditions for the B model. Okay. So that's in mathematics is known as the classical limit of the geometric Langlands duality. So here we see it comes naturally by choosing a different twist, a holomorphic topological twist of the gauge theory. So So there is some, well, actually, so I don't have time to explain what we did in this paper at all. So what we did was actually to understand what sort of loop operators exist in this holomorphic topological field theory. And let me just say, the big difference compared to the topological case is that on a topological case, you can study Wilson operators or at Hooft operators, namely the ones sort of which insert electric source into the gauge theory or magnetic source, but you cannot study some mixed ones, dionic sources, which are kind of the most interesting from the point of view of physics. And in this setup, one can insert arbitrary dionic sources, that is, some sort of mixed operators, and study their algebra. So that's what we did in this paper, basically study the algebra of those operators. But let me just say, okay, that's just an aside, and just say, I said there's some dualities for n equals 2 field theories which generalize this duality for the case, for the adjoint case. And the most well understood case of this is the following. So quiver theories. So let me explain. Well, these examples are labeled by Dynkin diagrams of simply laced Lie algebras, so they're of ADE type. But let me just look at the A case. So that, well, actually should draw a fine Dynkin diagram. So it's AK minus one quiver. So for every node, one assigns group SUN. So the group is taken to be and then what about the representation R? Well, representation R can be taken to be what's called by fundamental. So for every R, for every link in the Dynkin diagram, we take a representation which is the defining representation with respect to this factor and the dual of the defining with respect to this factor. So R is a n-dimensional bar and then 1 with respect to the rest and plus all others. Fundamentals. So one can check that in this case, this condition on the indices, well, this C of R equal to C of the adjoint is satisfied. And so, in this case, what's the prediction that gauge theory makes? Well, there's some moderate space of generalized Higgs bundles which one can construct for this G and R. But so what is the physical prediction? Well, first of all, there's a category of boundary conditions for the B model, which is a derived category, again, of this moduli space. So what are we supposed to say about it? Well, so first of all, what's the dual group? Well, in this case, there are many sort of different... the duality group is actually complicated in this case. It's not just like SL2Z. The duality group is actually the mapping class group of elliptic curve with K punctures. So... So this group acts as the duality group on this gauge theory. So the prediction then is that this duality group acts on the derived category of this moduli space by some sort of Fourier Mukai transform. Now one can, it's a pretty big group, so I'm not really sure how it acts on any concrete object here. One nice thing about this example is actually that this case is maximally close to the edge in the sense that there is some sort of analog of the Hitchin vibration. In the usual case, the Hitchin moduli space is actually fibered by Lagrangian and tori. Okay? And that's a very important aspect because this S duality acts by T duality on this torus vibration. In this case, there's also a torus vibration. It's not Lagrangian, and in fact, it's not even middle dimensional. It's dimensions less than the middle. But nevertheless, there's a fine space over which torus is fibered, And one can suspect that some framework I along this vibration is part of the duality group. So, and then there are some other elements in the complete mapping process. So I guess I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I have a question. So first of all, for these these topological theories you mentioned in the beginning, is it always true that you just have the semi-classical approximation when you try to compute the path integral? Do you have to worry about higher corrections?
No, I mean, okay, so it's not always true. So, like, in certain twists, you also have to worry about, what basically is always true, that there are non-perturbative corrections. But there might be non-perturbative ones. Depending on the precise twist and theory, you may not have them. So in the twist I consider, there are no non-perturbative corrections either.
So you just have to deal with the semi-classical?
Yeah, just semi-classical calculation.
And then I have another question. So for n equals 4, you gave us these three possible twists one can consider. Is there something similar for n equals 2?
For n equals 2, if you look at topological twists, there's only one. There's Donaldson twist, which does depend on, which gets all these non-perturbative corrections. So it's not very similar to the one I was trying to mimic.
If you have another global twist, you can.
Okay, yeah, so you can. There are different versions of the Donaldson twist. Nevertheless, no matter how you do it, it's always true that there will be non-perturbative corrections.
But I mean, there you were also able to, when you look at special manifolds, for example, products of two Riemann surfaces, to do a special construction.
Yeah, when this manifold is special, then there are infinite number of possible twists you can consider. So.
And then also for n equals 2.
Yeah, for n equals 2, and you have infinite number of twists. So most of them are pretty weird, so they're reduced to something which is not very well understood even in two dimensions. So namely, when one twists a two-dimensional sigma model, one usually says, okay, there is a U1 symmetry, so there's not much choice how you choose homomorphism from U1 to U1. So this has to be the identity one. Not even multiple is allowed, right? It's actually not true if the target manifold has some symmetries. In string theory, usually considering what Kolobyov manifolds, we don't have any continuous symmetry. But if you think about even non-compact Kolobyovs, or more generally about some target space, some non-compact manifolds, like Hitchin module space, or whatever. Actually, it can be a compact one, if it's not a Kolobyov. Then you can consider adding an extra piece to your, consider sort of modifying some diagonal subgroup from the usual R-symmetry group in this continuous symmetry. So we get some more general sigma model. That's what one generically gets. Some other choices, at least. These are not well understood. So kind of sigma models, and then two dimensions. So I haven't studied. But actually, they pop out in many different places. So I guess one has to understand.
Thank you very much.